Chevy Equinox with forward collision alert, automatic emergency braking, and available all-wheel drive. It's my ultimate mobile device. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com to schedule a test drive. Chevy Equinox. It's your choice. Own it.
John Williams here. Joe Brand there, getting ready for the Kane County Cougars baseball game. I guess we're wondering if the Cougars and the Cubs will get their games in today. What are you guys hearing, Joe, Domati? We going to play baseball in this town today?
Well, our game just got canned.
Oh, pardon me. You probably just said that, too.
No, I didn't. The Cougars game, is canceled, well postponed. We have a doubleheader tomorrow. Yeah. It looks like they're going to play at Wrigley as of right now.
Yeah, right. My brother's in town, and he's anxious to go to the game today. He's a big Cubs fan. And this is about it. And he goes, well, come. Are you going to come to – he's got four tickets. Is he going to come to the game with me? I go, I think I could say – I said, the games are televised. They've got these things on television now, and you can watch it in the comfort of your home.
It's kind of a labor to go out there these past few days. I mean, to bundle up. You have to be mentally ready. That's tough. It is tough to sit out there and watch a game for 3 to 4 hours.
Lou was talking about how few folks went to one of the White Sox games today, but that was the one. It was a weekday game, mm-hmm. and it was a game whose time they'd moved a couple of times, and the weather's just miserable. The home opener was a snowstorm. Then the second game was 70, and then it's been kind of back and forth. So this is a bad day to watch baseball in Chicago, but the Cubs game is still on, right?
As of right now, 1:20 p.m. first pitch they're looking forward to.
Do you guys remember the bit that Chris Farley used to do on Saturday Night Live where he was hosting what would look like a local cable access TV show, the Chris Farley Show?
Oh, yes.
But he would get great guests, and he could not stop gushing.
Hilarious.
Hi. Welcome to the Chris Farley Show. I'm Chris Farley, and my guest tonight is one of the greatest musicians, or rock musicians. I guess I didn't have to say who you were because, everyone knows who you are. You're Paul McCartney.
Paul McCartney is sitting right there the whole time.
Well, it's great to be here.
It's great to be here. On some...
He wasn't really dead, was he?
It was a great bit. It was a fun bit. Okay, so I want to tell you a story about my brother and his wife, who are in town this weekend, too. But they were in town last weekend, Sunday, before the Cubs' scheduled home opener, which is going to be on Monday. And we were in a bar, Brenda and me, and then my brother Mark and his wife Becky, and our friends Billy and Roberta King, the six of us. Billy is a financial advisor from Peoria, and over the years, this friend of ours, Billy King, has become good friends with Ferguson Jenkins, the Cubs' legendary Hall of Fame pitcher. And my brother is a great baseball fan and a greater Cubs fan still. He's off the charts. So Billy says that Ferguson Jenkins is going to join us at the bar. And my brother loses it. He got wind of the coming meeting with Ferguson Jenkins a couple of hours before we all arrived at the bar. So Mark starts studying. He's asking people to quiz him. How many wins did he have? And Mark knows the answer. How many 20-game seasons did he have? How many consecutive 20-game seasons did he have? How many complete games? How many other sports did he play? What's his age? What's his place of birth? He pretty much knew all of this stuff. But he wanted to make sure that he had it down. And once we all met, he wanted Ferguson Jenkins to know that he knew all of this stuff, too. It was sweet, but what we had really wasn't a conversation. It was more of a confirmation. Mark would tell Ferguson Jenkins things about Ferguson Jenkins' career as a way of demonstrating how he really did appreciate him as a player. Mark's no Johnny-come-lately fan. He knows his Ferguson Jenkins. And Jenkins, hearing all of his life sort of spit back at him, would acknowledge that, yes, all of those things are true. And as I'm listening to this conversation, I keep thinking about Chris Farley.
Well, it's great to be here. you remember when Remember when you were with the Beatles? Yeah, sure. Sure. That was awesome. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
I could play the whole thing for you. But you're right. Some of the maybe the best line was, remember when they were said you're dead? You weren't dead, right? Touche, Joe.
The end of it, too, is really good. I don't know if he'll play the whole thing, but when he quotes the line, the love you make is equal to the love you take, is that true?
And then Paul validates it. He goes, yeah, you know, what that means is that, you know, in life you get what you give. And he goes, yes! He does a double clutch fist pump. He goes, yes, Paul McCartney right here on my show.
So classic.
Hour and a half of that, only it's Ferguson Jenkins and my brother. Marcus Chris Farley, Ferguson Jenkins is Paul McCartney. And Mark's saying things to him like, so do you remember when you were in the All-Star game and you threw that pitch? And he goes, and I swear to God, he goes, yeah, I remember I was in the All-Star game. And Mark says, do you remember?
How was Fergie's reaction to all that? I mean, was he...
Could
he
not have
or?
Been more generous. Just yeah. What a, you know, I've been around town and the Cubs are on the station forever. I'm sure I bumped into Ferguson Jenkins several times, but I never had an hour and a half of him at a bar, so I can't say I know him, right? But I did this time, and he was just so sweet. He didn't know my brother, and you know, and he's been to this movie before. He could not have been more entertaining and patient, and he was kind of getting into it because. Suddenly, it was like a wiki of Ferguson Jenkins' career. Like, my brother was writing it right there with Ferguson Jenkins. So Mark just had these doe eyes. He was just looking up at Fergie, you know, losing his breath every now and then. And Jenkins was filling in the details. So Mark goes, well, do you remember when you were in the All-Star game and you struck out those guys? And Ferguson Jenkins says, yeah, I do, Mark. I remember I pitched in that game. And he says, do you remember the guys you struck out? And Jenkins says, yes, I do. And then they begin to name them. They walk through. Do you remember when you struck out Cal Ripken or whoever that was? You know, I don't remember the players. And Jenkins just looks great, really looks great, and was just having a ball. But he's leaving the bar then eventually.
One of the underappreciated lines from Mr. Deeds. Yeah, Stephen King came into our town. Everyone was afraid to say hi to him. He ordered gas at the gas station. The teller lost 200 pounds that night.
Jenkins walks out of the bar. He squeezes my arm and whispers into my ear, your brother doesn't know anything about sports. I said, I know. What are you going to do? It's very fun. When Bob Green, the then columnist for the Chicago Tribune, spent a year with Michael Jordan at the pinnacle of his career and wrote a book about spending a year with Michael Jordan, he said that one of the things he noticed was that when people would come up to Michael Jordan, they would speak very quickly because they didn't know how long they were going to have that opportunity. And so we all sound like floundering idiots, but you just can't believe that you're talking to him. You want to make sure you get... that Michael hears you say what you want to say. And so people say, oh, Michael Jordan, I love you so much. Your career's, remember the time you passed the ball to Scottie Pippen? You know, and he'd say, yes, I do. That's what we do. I have this question for you. 312-981-7200. I suspect you can relate a little bit. You can call or text, but tell me, when you met that famous person, who was it and how did it go? You met that famous person. You had a chance to talk to them. What was that you said? How did it go? 312-981-7200. Now, Joe and Domati, I don't know if you should play because you guys are in the media and you've met a lot of famous people. Griffin, you've met a lot of... I don't know, Griffin, have you met a lot of famous people?
Not really. Some people.
But as an average citizen, I guess we could... How about you, Joe? Who is the person that you got all agog? You got all Chris Farley'd when you got a chance to meet or talk to?
Yeah, I'm trying to think, and I mean, like you said, being in the media, you do have the opportunity to meet some very, very cool people. So, I mean, I have to go back to, like, when I was a kid. I guess I went up and met Ron Santo, and I said, you belong in the Hall of Fame, because this is obviously before he was in.
He loved to hear that.
And he's like, well, coming from you, that means a lot. I'm just some 12-year-old kid looking for an autograph.
Nobody.
I think he Chris Farley
was better than Santa. What's that?
Yeah, right.
I think he Chris Farley Joe. I think he got starstruck. I remember I met Lauryn Hill on my birthday. And, you know, my like, it's my birthday. And she was like, happy birthday. I was like, you too.
It wasn't her birthday, Domati.
It wasn't hers.
I'm so stupid. Oh, God, that's why did I say that?
Yes. Oh, man, it's terrible. And I have a picture of the moment.
Nice.
A terrible picture. No, right. No, it's not nice at all.
When did you, how old were you at the time?
25, John. I was a grown man. It's terrible.
No, I think we all, this is irrespective of age, Domati. We get it.
Well, thank you.
We'll take your calls. The lines are ringing. It's 10:24. John Williams, we're talking about my brother's chance meeting with Ferguson Jenkins and how he acted, which made me wonder, how did you act when you met somebody famous? This is John. You're on WGN. Hi, John.
Morning, John.
Hey.
Yeah, some years ago, I was at Indianapolis 500, and Paul Newman had a race team out there. And we were at time trials, and, you know, most of the day, me and my wife were putting a few back, and I was probably not in the best of shape. And I came out of, you know, gasoline alley area, and he was walking right by me. And as soon as I saw him, I was in awe, you know. But I couldn't think of anything but Cool Hand Luke. And I go, hey, Lukey, how's it going? Oh, Luke, oh, Cool Hand Luke. And he just looked at me like I was out of my mind.
I bet a lot of people do that. So you're doing George Kennedy to his. And he knows, I'm sure he knew what you were doing, but he's like, no, I don't, I'm not doing the movie, man. I'm not doing the
and
movie.
And the way I look, he's like, just get this, you know, wash bag away from me. This guy had it, you know.
I love it.
Thanks. A couple pictures, they were sideways, but it was worth it.
Thanks, it John. It. Have a good day.
Have a nice one.
Yeah, you too, man. Hey, Eric, you're on WGN.
How you doing?
Hey, what's up, man?
Not much. When I was about 7, my dad entered me a contest, and I got to go to a camp with Michael Jordan.
Oh.
So I was so, so excited until it got to the point at the end where you could take a picture with him, and I was so scared I didn't do it. And so my parents have a picture with Michael Jordan and another kid. That's the picture.
Why were you afraid to get you were just so in awe of him, huh?
In awe, yeah. He walked around, he helped us shoot, and that was cool. But when it got down to it, yeah, I couldn't handle it. And so, and my parents, my dad, he never looked so disappointed. As well. So he just with another kid, and that's it.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Eric.
Thank you.
Have a good day. Susan, you're on WGN. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What was yours?
I got to meet Barry Manilow at the Oprah show, and boy, was she pissed, actually.
Why?
Well, what happened was, it was a show all about him, and I wasn't invited because nobody knew I was a big fan, but I was sitting in the proper seat because he was on his way out, and I just, like, looked at him. He looked right at me, or probably the exit sign behind my head. And I said to him, can I just talk to you for a minute? And he said, sure. And then Oprah rolled her eyes. But then I had a little story to tell. He actually cured me from my breast cancer. And I wanted to thank him. And he couldn't have been nicer. He talked to me like we were the only two people in the room for about 10 minutes.
Wait a minute. How did Barry Manilow cure your cancer?
With his music. Basically.
Really?
I had really bad breast cancer, not really about me, but I had a stem cell transplant, and I was in isolation for 3 weeks in the hospital, and all I had was a Walkman at the time with my Barry Manilow music and a little Lyle Lovett, but it was mostly Barry Manilow.
So he got you through
it.
He got you through that. So then he's walking off the set, and you just grab him and say, Barry, you cured me of cancer. And Oprah's like, oh, for God's sakes, get this woman out of here, right?
No, actually, when I did, I just said, can I just talk to you for a minute? And
yeah.
He said, sure. And then the minute I said breast cancer, everybody like was chattering, you know, they're going to leave. And then they're all quiet and they're listening. And then I freaked out and I go, oh, my God, I can't do this. I'm talking to Barry Manilow. Oprah says, yes, you can. We're all listening. And then it was really sweet. And before they were ready to go, I said, can I just, you know, one more minute, I'm not done. She says, okay. And he once said to me, and this is, I think Maya Angelou said this, when everything's said and done, people won't remember what you've done. They remember how you made them feel. And I said, remember when you said that? And he said, yeah, I did. And he hugged me and he patted my back and asked my name. This man was like the nicest person in the world.
Yeah, I've heard that. And what a nice story. Susan, thanks for the phone call.
Hey, remember when you were in the Beatles and you did that album Abbey Road, and at the very end of the song, it goes, and in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. You remember that?
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes, Chris, in my experience it is, I find the more you give, the more you get.
10:39 on WGN. Thank you, Domati. This is John Williams. In the next hour, by the way, a little after your 11 o'clock news, the Mincing Rascals will talk about a number of topics that are in the news today, including Mark Zuckerberg's testimony before Congress and Paul Ryan's decision not to run for re-election. The Mincing Rascals, pretty dang good podcast, if I don't say so myself. If you don't listen to podcasts, you should. And if you do, make sure you listen to The Mincing Rascals. We broadcast part of that podcast a little after 11 o'clock. There's a book out titled The Journey of NEM, N-E-M. We'll get to the title in a minute. It's written by a woman named Erica Brannick. In the preface to her book, she says, it was a glorious day in Boston. The weather was sunny and just right. Not too warm for the runners, not too chilly for the spectators. My mother, Carol Downing, was running the Boston Marathon. My sister, Nicole, her husband, Michael, and I found a prime spot on Boylston Street near the finish line, ready to witness the completion of her amazing accomplishment. She writes, it was just so happy. And then I didn't actually hear the bomb go off because my eardrums were blown out instantly. But I remember this whomping noise and smoke and flashes. I blacked out. When I came to, my first thought was, no, this is not happening. And I closed my eyes. I had a conversation with God. I said, you are not taking me yet. I'm not done. I'm not leaving. 50 days and 11 surgeries later, I left my Boylston family, the nurses and doctors and staff at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital, to resume my life, which had become starkly different. Her name is Erica Brannick, and the book is a children's book. And I'll tell you what, it works for us adults, too. Erica, this is John. You're on WGN Radio in Chicago. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, John?
Very good. And literally, how are you doing? You're well? You're able to resume your life? Things are going good?
I am well. I am. I am back teaching again. I'm enjoying my time with my kids. It feels very almost normal again.
What did you suffer? What was the result of that injury from the Boston attack?
So I lost the lower part of my leg on my left side, and I have bone missing by my right ankle on my right leg.
I see. So who did you write this book for then? I described it as a children's book. You are a school teacher, right?
Yes, I'm a preschool teacher.
So did you write it for your kids?
I did. I wrote it to them because part of my job at my school is to teach a special that we have called Community, and they learn about the part, how they are a part of their community, what they can do for it, how we all get along together, and we learn about differences and different religions and how to accept each other and accept our differences. So I've been doing this for a while, and I wanted a broader audience to reach. So a book sounded like the perfect idea.
Yeah. But how do you teach kids about the value of community when the backdrop is the Boston Marathon?
It's very tricky. So they don't really know that that's where I was hurt. They just know that I got in a bad accident and I was hurt and my doctors had to give me a new leg because I wanted to teach them that there's all different kinds of reasons why you could have this kind of difference, and didn't want them to be fearful of it or be scared that it could happen to them and more focus on there's someone with this difference and you have a difference, but it's all okay because it makes us special.
So you told the story through the person of a dragonfly.
I did, yes. Dragonflies are my favorite animal.
I see. So, all right, so then you are the dragonfly essentially in this story?
I am represented through the dragonfly, yes.
And what happens to the dragonfly?
So she is in a storm in her town and gets hit against the largest tree in town. And part of her wing gets broken, and they have to take it off.
So she can't fly anymore.
She can't fly. She has to get around in a wheelchair for a while until she gets her prosthetic wing.
Yeah. It's nicely illustrated, too. My
illustrator did a great job.
Yeah. And the part of the book that it's also touching. But you say Nem. Why is the dragonfly named Nem?
So Nem stands for Nicole Erica Michael. So it's my sister, myself, and my brother-in-law.
Nice. So Nem, the dragonfly, noticed that other dragonflies that flew by would look at her, but were not scared of her. The little dragonflies were not scared, and no one flew away. When you were talking about this in the book, I thought, and it's illustrated, I mean, that's virtually one page of a book that's about 20 or 30 pages. It's a children's book. But I just thought this is such a nice passage because it's not all about you. I think if I was reading this to my child, I would want them to take away from this passage that if you see somebody else who's different, who has a prosthetic or is in a wheelchair or somehow is different than you, don't be afraid of them. Don't fly away.
Exactly.
Interact with them. And that's the gift of this book.
Yeah, that's what I really wanted to focus on is that these kids don't have to be fearful of someone that has a difference. They're curious about it. Most of the time, these people are comfortable talking about it and educating people on it.
Yeah. I mean, if somebody goes through some traumatic event and they are now different, this book will help them. But I think most people, fortunately, don't suffer what you did. And yet,
yes.
Here's the great takeaway is that this is written for both perspectives. You were at mm-hmm. the Boston Red Sox game last night, right? What happened there?
Yes. So we were honored a few other of the survivors and first responders from the 2013 attack were honored to come out on the field during the pregame ceremony and were given amazing rounds of applause and support for our continued journey of recovery.
What was that like?
It was amazing. It was very emotional. It was a very long walk to second base. But it was great to just take in all of the love from the fans.
Well, yeah, no kidding, because they had you enter the field from center field, right?
Yes, all the way in the back.
So then you walk all the way through the outfield to second base where the ceremony takes place. And I suppose there was a reason for that. Why did they make you walk that far?
So they showed a video of each person and gave the crowd a background of what had happened to us and what we're up to now. So by the time we got halfway to where we were, they finally introduced us and we got the cheers from everyone.
Yeah. Well, and you walk with a prosthetic then, do you?
Yes, I do.
I think that's part of it too, right? I mean, I think people wanted to cheer your mobility on.
Yes, it was a great moment. It was very emotional, and it was wonderful seeing everyone cheering for, especially me, who's not from Boston.
Where are you from?
And I'm from Baltimore, Maryland.
Ah, you know.
So I actually was with the team they were playing against last night.
Well, that's delicate for you now, isn't it?
Yes, I like to toe the line of supporting both.
Yeah, no kidding. So you're in Boston now. For the marathon. Have you been going back ever since?
Yes, I've come back every year.
Are you able to run in it or do you participate?
I don't participate, but thankfully the Boston Athletic Association gives the survivors and their families entries every year, and we can either use them ourselves or give them to someone to run in our honor.
Oh.
So I've been fortunate enough to give them to people who are important to me to run in my honor.
Well, what a nice gesture on their part, and what a great book you have written here. And again, it's called So NEM, the first letters of the three people and important to the author, The Journey of NEM, N-E-M. It's written by Erica Brannick. And you can get it wherever you buy children's books. You can sure get it on Amazon.com. Our friend Steve Alexander, who works with us at WGN Radio, has published this book. I would be doing this either way, but I'm happy for both of you. What a pleasure to meet you, Erica, and congratulations on your journey. Well done.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, I just can't get through that. I cry just a little bit every time I read her book, and it's for children. You'd read it in a matter of minutes, but you'll remember it when you do. It's 10:49. This is WGN. It's 10:53. By the way, speaking of books for kids, that one's written for small children or anybody, the one we just did, The Story of NEM. But there's also a book for juveniles that's been written, and this is more for middle schoolers and high schoolers, by James Swanson. He's a New York Times best-selling author. He wrote a book called Chasing King's Killer. It's about Martin Luther King and James Earl Ray. They were both in California to the day 3 weeks before James Earl Ray killed Martin Luther King Jr. They were both in California 3 weeks before, and they would both leave California, and fatefully their lives would again intersect. We posted a long conversation I had with this author on our website this week. If you just go to my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John. You'll hear a fascinating interview there. But here's just a couple minutes of it, where he was describing how they were both in California and would bump into each other, obviously, again.
But he was living the nightlife of a barfly and a solitary man with no real connections. And then all of a sudden, in March 1968, Martin Luther King goes to California, to Los Angeles, speaks in Anaheim, gives a sermon in a church. James Earl Ray doesn't attend. But the day King leaves town, Ray gets in his Mustang and drives all the way across America to Georgia and then to Tennessee. And 3 weeks later, King is dead. And Ray never told us why. I have some theories about why, but we don't know because he wouldn't tell us.
What do you think?
I think he wanted to achieve some kind of significance in life. He realized his life was empty. It had no meaning. He wanted to do something to be remembered. When he escaped from prison for his petty crimes, he fantasized that he'd be in the FBI Most Wanted list. After he killed Martin Luther King, he went to a bar to watch television and asked them to turn on that old show, The FBI, with Ephraim Zimbalist, because at the end of each of those shows, they would name the most wanted man in America. And he loved watching himself on television. It gave him meaning, and Martin Luther King was the means through which this was done.
Up to that point, though, well, he was a career criminal and an escaped criminal. The most there was ever a warrant for his arrest was $50.
Yes.
The highest bounty he'd ever achieved.
Yes.
So he was really small potatoes. He was not on the radar of anybody.
No.
As he was intersecting with Martin Luther King Jr.
No, he was not.
You opened the book with the scene where Martin Luther King is stabbed in the chest by a distraught woman, a crazy woman, with a letter opener.
Well, it was 1958 in New York. King had achieved some fame as a leader of the Montgomery, Alabama bus strike. And he got on the cover of Time magazine, and he decided to write his first book. He went to New York City, to Harlem, for a book signing, and went to Bloomstein's department store in September 58. The night before, at one of his rallies, a very attractive, well-dressed black woman was heckling him. And then the next day, she showed up at the book signing. No one realized it was the woman from the night before, and she said, "Are you Martin Luther King?" And he said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "I've been after you for 5 years. You've ruined my life." And she reached in her purse. It's a good thing she didn't reach for her bra, because she was hiding a pistol in her bra. And said she reached for a razor-sharp Japanese letter opener. It was really like a miniature samurai sword, 6 or 8 inches long, like an ice pick. She raised her arm, and she stabbed him in the heart before he could stop her. And he was rushed to the hospital, and he almost died. If he had moved a little, it would have cut his aorta. But he was spared. He was saved. Surgery was performed. And that gave him the choice of deciding what kind of life did he want to have. Did he want to go back south and live the life that his father had lived, a prominent minister, leader in the community? Or did he want to become a leader and follow his destiny? So that put him on a 10-year arc that led him to Memphis. He said later, he said, "Well, we must all be prepared to die." And then the scar over his heart healed in the form of a cross. And he joked, and he said, "That's an appropriate scar for a minister of the gospel."
What a story. That's James L. Swanson, and he's a University of Chicago guy. Studied history there and wrote the book Chasing King's Killer, the full interview with just more anecdotes. I did not know that anecdote that he just told us. It's eye-opening. You can read this book with your teenagers in a couple of hours as well. Is the book, I lost my train of thought on there, but it's Chasing King's Killer by James L. Swanson. It's 10:57. We've got WGN Radio News coming up. Doma T, this is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio here on WGN Radio and on Michigan Avenue. I know three people that have a birthday yesterday. Three people. One of them is Thomas Jefferson, your third president. And so he sent me a text and he said, "Hey, how you doing, my favorite slime ball?" And I said, "How are you doing?" He said, "It's my birthday." I said, "Come on the show." So he did. And at the end of the conversation, he said, "There are five things I want for my birthday." He'd thought about it. Did you hear this conversation? If you did and can identify some of them in the next half hour, you'll win a prize. We'll play that part of the conversation. And you can hear it in its entirety at WGNRadio.com. Thomas Jefferson's coming to town again in August. Tickets aren't on sale yet. I'm not even announcing the venue, but I just want you to know TJ and I will kick things around again on stage for you in August. But now the Mincing Rascals, which is the podcast we record at the studios at WGN Radio, usually on Thursdays. A quick note about the Mincing Rascals podcast. The Lissagore Awards go to Chicago journalism's finest. In print, TV, radio, and web-based journalism, the Lissagore Awards are the ones everybody roots for. And at WGN Radio, the Hogue and Johns podcast, which talks about sports, was one of three finalists for Best Podcast. And the Mincing Rascals was also one of the finalists for Best Podcast in the city of Chicago. Kudos to Eric Zorn, Kristen McQuarrie, and Scott Stantis from the Chicago Tribune, Steve Bertrand and me, and sometimes Patty Vasquez and Justin Kaufman, the gang from WGN Radio. On this podcast broadcast of the Mincing Rascals, we let Kristen McQuarrie speak first. Here the gang is talking about Paul Ryan, the House Speaker from nearby Janesville, Wisconsin. Kristen's talking about Paul Ryan, his job, why he quit, and what he accomplished.
I think there are lots of things that make his job difficult and make Washington difficult, not just Trump, but having to deal with a caucus that's, you know, severely divided between more establishment Republicans and the Freedom Caucus.
And a job he never wanted.
And a job he never wanted. So, and you have to, you know, we are in an election year. He doesn't want Republicans to lose the House, and it's looking like, of course, they're going to, but he's not going to badmouth Trump
and risk that. The Republicans will lose the House?
Yes, I do.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's way too many congressmen stepping down now.
Where Republicans have won.
Well, we have a liberal Democratic senator from the state of Alabama.
So what do you think about all this, Eric Zorn?
It seems to me that Ryan has basically failed in his overall mission, which was he wanted, you know, to bring the budget in line, and the budget, thanks in part to this, you know, tax quote unquote reform that we have. When he came to Congress, he was the wonky guy from Wisconsin who knew his budget tricks. I think he failed in that. I don't know what you can point to as an accomplishment. You know, he's always wanted to cut entitlements. He's been unable to do that.
Kristen has a very concerned look on her face. I don't know why.
I know. This is so painful to listen to, because I think he was one of the people willing to put votes on entitlement reform. You say cuts. Well, we have to do something. I mean, basically, Social Security, Medicare, it's a Ponzi scheme. We are all paying into a pyramid scheme that is going to run out of money. And nobody wants to talk about it. And it's among the frustration of Trump voters and Freedom Caucus members is that they send fiscal conservatives to Washington and they won't change anything. And nobody was talking about this before Paul Ryan.
I think one of the reasons he'll be glad to not be in the Congress is because he's not going to be having to figure out how to pay for some of this stuff.
They are counting on economic growth. I know.
I'm sorry, I do too. I shouldn't laugh. What's the matter, Scott?
I don't laugh because it has worked in the past. The fact is you pour more capital into an economy. There's more capital for people to do innovation, job creation. And it does work to a certain extent. The increases during the Reagan administration, when they had the budget cut, the tax cuts, the tax revenues actually went up. The problem is, as it always is that the Congress spends like drunken Democrats. And they spend at a pace that is far faster than the rate of revenue coming in.
This is the hardest speakership to ever endure.
Right. This is a Kemp slash Republic, Reagan Republican who had those ideals, and those ideals are dead and gone now in this Republican.
But I think, and you're right, you can explain away his, you know, being silent to Trump or being quiet to Trump and all of that in the present moment. All of that makes some sort of sense. I do think in 20 years we will look back and we will remember him as a guy who acquiesced in the face of a man who didn't belong in the White House.
Trump was elected.
He wasn't elected.
The Speaker of the House could not during the course of this, while trying to pass policy, which I do think was Paul Ryan's focus, be throwing the president of the United States under the bus and then disenfranchising the whole Freedom Caucus and all the people who actually have supporters in their districts who strongly support President Trump. That would have been a terrible thing for him to do.
He showed some spine during the election when he was speaking out against Trump. But then when the rubber hit the road with things like Charlottesville, in places where he did not show any courage, he didn't show any principle. I mean, he wanted to get his tax cuts through, but what did he get? I mean, do you think he would have been unable to pass the tax bill if he had been critical of Trump, if he had been leading? I mean, the question that keeps coming up is what's happened to the Republican Party? And part of it is that they've all gone into this crouch, this fetal position over Trump. And, I mean, I think there are a lot of really principled Republicans out there, but you just don't hear from them anymore because they're all afraid of these core Trump voters who they think can't deal with any bad medicine that might come from.
That's why I keep wondering if he's going to go all Flake on us at some point. Senator Flake, on the way out, now speaking his mind.
And he won't, and because he would have by now. And I understand what you're saying, Kristen, about all of that, but some of the stuff he's done has hurt the country. And I wish the Republicans had governed as if Trump wasn't a Republican president. I wish the Republicans in the Congress had just taken over and said, we're a third of this government and we're going to do what we need to do and we'll see what the president does.
I just think you're underestimating the Trump enthusiasm that is still out there.
I don't think these Trump supporters are so wild-eyed that they can't deal with somebody, you know, selectively and surgically criticizing the president for things that he's doing. I mean, I don't think you have to be a cheerleader for Trump to maintain the support of Trump voters.
He hasn't been a cheerleader for Trump, and it also bothers me when we judge Trump's someone up based on what they say. You know, somebody sticks a microphone in your face, and we all have to react every day to what Trump tweets or says or whatnot, and we want Governor Rauner to respond to everything Trump says or does. It's silly. It's lazy reporting. We shouldn't be putting people on the spot all the time to have them react to something that's
but shouldn't he have been proactive?
Well,
he's had plenty of time to measure his words and thoughts. And
he
come
has.
Up.
He makes the point, or he argues that he could get more done by privately talking to the president than by publicly criticizing him.
Duh! Like that is smart.
As an American citizen, I would like to see some Republicans step up and say this is wrong. What the president is tweeting, saying, or doing sometimes. And as a leader of the Republicans,
of the country, he's the House
and
Speaker.
And what he says sometimes is, when asked, "Do you support the president's tweet?" he'll say, "No, I don't think that was a good idea." But he never takes that next step.
He is the leader of the caucus, and he would be ineffective if he did not, you know, understand that a lot of his caucus members are Trump supporters.
Okay.
And
but was he effective?
Members. I think he was effective at keeping the caucus together for the time that he has been Speaker.
Don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying he's a failure. I think he missed opportunities. I think he came up short when there was an opportunity to really take difficult leadership positions that might have hurt him and might have hurt the caucus, but he did not step up and lead.
On a personal level, Steve, I think that picture he took where he's got the Trump signature thumbs up the day after he announces that he's going to not run for Congress again, I think that's going to be his legacy. He was their thumbs up for President Trump. And I don't think history is going to judge Trump well. And therefore, I think his acquiescence to President Trump is going to be on him. And he can talk about all the time he wants to spend with his kids. But I think that's using his kids as a convenient way out. Someday those kids are going to look back at that picture and say, "Dad, what were you doing?"
I don't believe for a second if things were going well in the country, if he had confidence in Trump and if he felt like things were like on a path for him to continue to be Speaker, I think he'd be staying.
Senator Dick Durbin asked Mark Zuckerberg if he'd like to share with everyone where he stayed last night.
Mr. Zuckerberg, would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
If you messaged anybody this week, would you share with us the names of the people you've messaged?
Senator, no, I would probably not choose to do that publicly here.
I think that might be what this is all about.
It was a great point for Durbin. Are you guys mad at Zuckerberg or Facebook?
And what do you want either of them to do?
I don't get this, frankly.
I'm with you.
It's like when, and I keep bringing up Dominic's because.
Why?
When I used to go to Dominic's and use my Dominic's card, Dominic's knew what I bought. They knew when I bought it. They knew what I bought with it. And then they gave that information to Procter & Gamble or Heinz Ketchup or whatever.
And they generated coupons at checkout.
Exactly. So when I'm playing in Mark Zuckerberg's Facebook Playbox or Sandbox, I understand that the information I'm putting out there is no longer just mine. I do understand that if you're violating policy and sharing contrary to that policy or rules, that's the stuff that needs to be cleaned up. But as far as my quote-unquote data being shared, my birthday's February 3rd, 1963. There, you all know it.
Part of the data was sold to a company to use in a political campaign. So that's where I think we've crossed a line. But the point of that is to influence people, and we're influenced by political television ads and political mail and all kinds of, and social media and tweets and everything we're influenced by. So I'm just going to rest my case with Steve's brilliant description.
And I'm going to go home.
I don't have outrage because guess what? You know how much I pay for Facebook? About as much as you guys pay for it.
Right.
It's free. So how do they monetize it? They monetize it using mining the information that I voluntarily give to a free service. I'm not outraged by this.
To quote Bob Dole, where's the outrage?
I would like there to be more transparency as to where this data is going. Can anyone name a time where you felt like your privacy has been violated in a way that threatens or scares or disadvantages you in some way on Facebook? Yes, actually I can. Janine's father, without getting into detail, was having kidney issues, needed a catheter. She looked up and saw where she can get one online. For the next 8 months, apparently she looked it up on my computer, because for the next 8 months I got ads asking me, what do you think of this catheter? Hey, here's one.
Yeah, but what's offensive about that? What's offensive about that?
Well, catheters?
No, seriously, you were looking for catheter information.
Yes.
So it wasn't helpful that...
We had made that decision and went forward and purchased the said catheters, but for the following almost more than half a year... these things kept popping.
I made in a weak moment clicked on some underwear ad. These are the best underwear ever.
Oh, right, it was a weak moment.
For a year, I'm looking at men in their underwear.
But you can choose not to click on it, right?
It's a small price to pay for the service that Facebook and Gmail and those things offer for free. In my opinion,
very different though is I do think, and I don't know this come up as much, but what they do need to crack down on are the fabricated stories that get shared and the misinformation that gets shared. That is a threat. That is a danger.
I think that's a good point, Steve, because we're all talking about how it's something that we volunteer and that if ads follow us, it's a price to pay. I'm completely with that. But the fact that they seem to know what buttons to push, what alarms you, they seem to not only know what you're interested in, but they seem to know something about your personality. And then that's what came from this Cambridge thing, is that then they actually craft ads or posts that seem to play on your fears about immigration or about guns. And that is how you influence an election. I don't know the solution to that. I don't know that Zuckerberg does. And frankly, I don't know that you can. I liken it these days to air pollution. It's out there. You breathe it. You wish it wasn't there. You should safeguard yourself from it. But what can you do about data sharing or misinformation? I have no hope or expectation that they or anybody can. I think this is totally on us as consumers.
Should Facebook or YouTube be a platform for some of these really crazy, sick, weird conspiracy theories like Pizzagate? Should they censor those the way they do pornography?
How would you identify them?
That's the question. Do you really want somebody at Facebook screening what shows up in your feed? I certainly do not, and I don't want the government to do it either. Maybe he did testify that they are trying to do that.
They are trying to
identify like fake accounts, and I'm fine with that if it's not connected to a real person and they have some algorithms where they can figure that out.
Yeah.
Once again, we're in his sandbox, so I think I'm perfectly fine with him doing that. That's the free market, but I am all for them censoring what's on there.
You know what the I think the number
so no conservative news then, since he doesn't.
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. Nothing.
Okay, well, some accusations that there are people getting blocked, that there is less of a tolerance for conservative news floating around.
Are you aware of any ad or page that has been taken down from Planned Parenthood?
Senator, I'm not, but let me just...
How about moveon.org?
Sorry?
How about moveon.org?
I'm not specifically aware of those.
How about any Democratic candidate for office?
I'm not specifically aware.
Do you know of those 15,000 to 20,000 people engaged in content review How many, if any, have ever supported financially a Republican candidate for office?
Senator, I do not know that.
I think ultimately what we're all talking about and the big takeaway from all of this is we owe MySpace a big apology.
Scott Stantis with a score at the end of today's broadcast of the Mincing Rascals podcast, nominated for a Chicago Elisagor Award. So too is our Domati Pongo, who is nominated for a feature radio report as well. Domati's got the news coming up in 6 minutes. It's 11:26 on WGN. Domati's going to do the news about 11:30. Griffin's always got our producer Griff something in the Vibe Score segment. He'll open with a song. We'll listen to it. We'll learn about it. We'll judge it on a scale of 1 to 100. A couple of other things in the world that caught his eye and your ear. And then also we'll give you a chance. Some of you called right away. I don't need you to call yet, but if you were listening earlier this week, you heard our conversation with President Thomas Jefferson, who volunteered 5 things that if he could have these for his birthday, he would be a happy man. He would have died a happy man. What were 2 or 3 of those? Don't answer yet. You'll get a chance to cash in on your good listening after 11:30. I'm reading in the Chicago Tribune today. The winner of a $533 million lottery jackpot was not sure he could believe his eyes. So when his mother called to say someone in his new home state had won it, his response was, well, it wasn't me. Richard Wall, 47, Vernon, New Jersey, was introduced Friday at the lottery headquarters after winning the March Mega Million drawing. Production manager at a food service company said he plans to retire and take the cash payout of $220 million. I wouldn't do it that way. I'd go with the 20-year annuity. Everybody tells me that's wrong, but that's what I would do. He moved to New Jersey from Michigan in July. He described finding out he had the winning ticket late at night. Some of my family members were sleeping, so I didn't go and scream out. I walked upstairs, I saw my wife, and I said, baby, we get to go on vacation. She said, what are you talking about? Don't be an idiot. He wasn't an idiot. I've often thought, that's the joy of buying a lottery ticket. It's not that you're going to win, you're not. But it gives you license to dream about how you would handle that moment. What fun.
I got a feeling called the blues. Oh, Lord, since my baby said goodbye.
All right, fine, Griffin. Lord, we'll listen to this.
All I don't know how to do. All I do is sat and sigh. Oh, Lord, that last long day she said goodbye. Well, Lord, I thought I would cry. She'll do me, she'll do you. She's got the kind of loving. Lord, I love to hear her when she calls me sweet daddy.
It's 11:38 on WGN. This is John Williams. This is our Vibe Score segment. On Saturdays, producer Griffin takes this opportunity to introduce us to some music that maybe we should know a little bit about. And then we score it on a scale of 1 to 100. And, well, that wasn't hip-hop. What was that, Griffin? What are you doing there?
Lovesick Blues by Hank Williams.
And that's the same song that the boy from downstate Harrisburg, Illinois, has become famous for yodeling.
Oh, I guess that's true. I didn't even consider that.
What a coincidence. Yeah. You just happened to be a big Hank Williams yodeling fan.
He's on my mind lately.
Yeah, I wonder why. So, what are we doing here, Griff? What the hell, Griff?
I guess, who do you like better? Who did it better? Who wore it best?
Well, in a minute, because I've got it in my queue there, Griff. It's the boy yodeling, both at Walmart and then on the Ellen show. He did a different song, I think, on Ellen. I think both are good.
Yeah.
But to be honest with you, who among us knows enough about yodeling to judge? Having now heard Hank Williams and now the little boy from Harrisburg, I think the boy from Harrisburg's got some chops. I think he was actually very good.
I agree. There's a reason it went viral. Is he better? No, I don't actually care. I just think everybody's got this tune in their head, but actually it took me a long time to go back and actually visit the original.
Yeah,
I was so enamored with the little kid
that I kind of
forgot that, like, oh yeah, he is singing a song that exists. I could listen to
it. I know that, but it's rare that the cover makes you, that you like the cover better, you know, than the original. In this case, I like the original. I like the little boy better, but props to Hank. Nice job. Mm-hmm. So on the Hank Williams, I'm giving that an 85.
Yep.
little boy, 93.
I think that's...
Sorry, Hank, if you're listening.
Yeah, sacrilege. I'd give Hank Williams a 95.
You just...
I like the kid. I'd give him an 80.
But you don't like little kids. Dominator, go.
I'm going to defer to Joe. I don't know if I'm a yodel expert. I don't...
And Joe, as we all know, is yeah. out at the King County Cougar Stadium. Joe?
You know what? I'll go a 90 for both of them. Because when I first heard the kid, obviously he's got a great voice, a ton of talent, but I could never really catch how the song goes. Now when you actually hear the music to it, you can actually catch the rhythm of it. So I do like the original, but they're both good to their own regard.
I'm a little comfortable with the lyric. What exactly is he talking about when he's singing about... She's got a little for you and a little for me. I'm like, really? I know I worry too much about the words of songs, but I'm listening to it now, and I'm like, oh, that's what that little kid is talking about at the Walmart? I don't know. By the way, we have a very special guest vibe scorer, John Hansen, who is filling in for Amy Guth today, is in the studio. 1 to 100. Your thoughts?
75.
75.
I don't think the kid has enough stage presence. He kind of just leans up on his tippy toes a little bit and sings the song.
He's like standing exactly straight up.
Right.
But also, I detect some slouch, but it's not actually... He's got the weirdest posture. Right. I think that's actually why it went viral, truly.
Just how basic he is in standing there.
His outfit... the way he stands is so strange.
Yeah.
And the whole picture together.
I saw a post that he sung at Coachella. They brought him on the stage. In all seriousness, found him and brought him on the stage
he was at
a music festival.
I hope we don't ruin this kid.
Right.
I hope that we don't.
Oh, we already have. We're doing it right now.
I mean,
that's what we're
second week in a row.
Then, yes.
You remember the little kid who was at the county fair, and they asked him, and he says he likes to watch the Powerball.
That was apparently.
Apparently, remember
apparently
that kid?
Yeah, yeah. That was good.
And he started, and he did the rounds with Ellen and Jimmy, and he was starting to pop up a little too much. And I'm like, can't we just let these kids be precious and then let them go instead of having them make fair appearances? Right.
Yeah, I hear you, but the answer is no. We just can't. As soon as something goes viral, if it involves a child, anybody under the age of like 17,
yeah, right.
Then it's like, when are they going on Ellen? She's really got that market cornered. Well, she doesn't even say anything about it. People are like, when is he going to be on Ellen?
I would be okay if that were the one stop, but when you call now and they say, well, talk to our agent. I go, oh, crap, really? The kid's got an agent? I hate that. Okay, so that's that. Griffin, give us another thing to a vibe on, please.
When is James Comey going to go on Ellen? I don't know how you give that a number.
No, but
he's got a book coming out.
Okay, I haven't read the Comey book. Let's vibe the Comey book. You ready? None of us have read it. I've read 3 reviews of it. What I'm hearing about the book is what I also heard about Fire and Fury, that while the salaciousness of it will make headlines, it seems to be a pretty good telling of that story. That was my review of Fire and Fury. You know, you heard about all these things about President Trump from that reporter. But at the end of the day, I thought that Fire and Fury read like you think this White House is. And it wasn't any crazier than the day's news. That's what I'm hearing about Fire and Fury. I'm giving Fire and Fury an 89. How about that?
Well, that's
pretty good.
Okay.
From someone who has not read a word.
No, you have read you're getting it mixed up. You said Fire and Fury, which you have read.
Pardon me. Yeah, Fire and Fury, I'll give an 89, and I'm giving Loyalty or whatever it is.
Whatever it is.
89.
I'll give it an 80. A solid 80, a B minus.
Yeah, no.
I have not read a single word.
No. The numbers should indicate your likelihood of reading the book. Is that still an 80?
100.
No. Yeah,
100.
I'd say 100 as well.
I'm reading all the books. I read Corey Lewandowski's book, for God's sakes. I'm definitely reading James Comey's book.
You're in the business of reading these books. You have to. I don't see myself reading.
You don't
want to.
Yeah, it's not something you're anxious to get your nose into.
No, I'm a 20.
How about you, Dominator?
I too have to read these books, but I've got mixed feelings about this. News is starting to get tabloidy. Like I like the fact that we can look into what's happening in the White House. We always wonder what these presidents are like in their private moments, but it's starting to feel like the National Enquirer.
I completely agree with that. Yeah. And I think that is the problem with the reviews of this book. Friday, we talked to the guy who did read it and review it for the Washington Post, their bureau chief for WAPO. He says, And he starts talking about these things, about Trump's orange face and white little bags under his eyes and his hair and all of that stuff. And I said, isn't it a shame that that's what this is about? He said, that's a very small portion of the book. Mm-hmm. The reviews are all capturing that. But he said the book is more substantial than that.
Well, I think it's interesting when you're looking for an insider baseball look at what is happening behind the scenes, and you're looking for those details, those extra details that'll get you more fascinated. But when the news every single day is so extreme, I don't think that there's going to be anything. I mean, I think it'll intrigue some of us, but I don't think it will provide those massive headlines that we think that maybe it will, because most of this stuff is out in the public already. But we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
I agree with that.
Griffin, one more. I want to do indoor baseball, outdoor baseball.
Okay.
You get no retractable roof. You get a stadium. What do you want?
I definitely want outdoor baseball.
Griffin, indoor or outdoor?
Outdoor.
Outdoor.
Yeah.
Domitee.
Baseball was made for the outdoors.
Joe Brand, this is your baby. I'm going to say whatever Joe Brand says.
Outdoor, John. It's always outdoor.
What is that? Come on. You thought you were going
to
get...
I thought there was a conversation to be had here. It's snowing hard in Minneapolis. It's 23 degrees. White Sox won't play today, and they ain't going to play no doubleheader tomorrow.
Right, so it's more like forget baseball about. In April, yes or no.
Yes. You want to talk about moving around the schedule. That's you want to talk about question, moving around yeah. the schedule. There we've got a conversation.
Yeah, no kidding. Fair enough.
Don't you
yeah.
just wish you could play in Tropicana or whatever that was? Come on.
The Trop.
It's 11:46. Okay, let's do this. Thank you, Griffin. Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, celebrated a birthday yesterday. And at the end of the conversation, he said, hey, if I could have anything for my birthday, here are five things you could get me. If you can name two of the five, I've got a prize for you. It's 11:51. John Hanson and I, he's getting ready to fill in for Amy Guth. We were just talking off the air about the Holocaust Museum, which is in Skokie. And you have been to three. I have been to two. You were at the one in Berlin.
Berlin. I've been to the one in Berlin, Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C., as have I. And you've been to the one in Skokie.
Yeah, and I think I've been to a few others. Because, you know, a lot of big cities have them, especially where there's a big Jewish population. And we were just talking about which exhibitions are which ones. But any one you go to leaves you with that just sense of awe and
history,
yes.
and how important this is. And sometimes when it gets to a very local level, like even a town that is as important in this conversation as Skokie, you don't expect something as impactful. The museum in Skokie is so well done, so well thought out. And some of the things they have there. Now, maybe I'll confuse what I saw in Washington, D.C. with what I saw in Skokie. But as I recall, they have one of the boxcars, mm-hmm. literally, that were used. And I think they have the buttons from some of the people who did not survive the death camps. I know in Washington, D.C., they have the shoes. Mm-hmm. All of that just takes your breath away. The guy who has been the vice president of our museum in Skokie is a man named Aaron Elster. And Wednesday night, he passed away on the eve of Holocaust Remembrance Day. He was a good man, and he really worked hard at this. This was so important to him. I interviewed him. He wrote a book about his experiences, and then he and a friend of mine, Warren Winkler, went up there and toured it. And I was just taken aback by two things again. One, how well done it was, and then number two, the message that it conveys. At some point, you have to go to the Holocaust Museum in Skokie. There will be a service for Mr. Elster Monday at 1 o'clock at Shalom in Arlington Heights at the Memorial Park there. And he was a good man. He will be missed, but his legacy and his work will not. You need to see the Holocaust Museum in Skokie. It's 11:53. Hey, we did get a winner. Is that on line one, Griffin? Okay, so we said Thomas Jefferson was on our show the other day. His birthday, I believe, was yesterday. And Pete, did you listen to that conversation?
I heard every little bit of it. The only thing I haven't managed to do is actually attend one of your conversations.
Oh, you got to come
Thomas.
To one of these shows. Okay, so what did Jefferson say he wants for his birthday?
For Monticello, he wants a tiller.
Yes.
To make it easier on his slaves. He wanted a 5,000-gallon plastic cistern because none of the ones he could make were watertight. And he wanted a photocopier to reduce the number of copies he had to handwrite. He wanted a case of wine. Now, these two I'm a little vague on. He wanted a case of wine. I don't remember the actual name of the type of wine from France.
Oh, well, hold on, because I think I can get that for you. Here's, boy, you're good. You're good. Here's TJ.
You mentioned my birthday.
Yes.
I do have a list of gifts, if you have a pen.
All right, hold on. Violetta, write these down. Steve, I don't know if you're going to shop.
I'm ready. I love birthdays.
Thomas Jefferson.
I have six things on my list. They're very brief.
Wow.
First, a case of Chateau Yquem. One of the great wines of France.
That's Steve's area. Steve, I'll let you pick the Chateau E.
Secondly, I would like a high-end scanning and copying machine. Imagine what I could have done with a scanner.
We'll get him a fax machine, and he'll be marveling at it.
I will revolutionize the world. Third, I would like a rototiller, because I have huge gardens. Fourth, I would like a large cistern made of plastic, because when I had these terrible problems with water at Monticello, and I made all these cisterns out of wood and out of ceramics and so on. They all leaked. If I had a 5,000-gallon plastic cistern, all my difficulties would be over. And perhaps fifth, I would like a loan of $108,000, if that doesn't seem...
$108,000.
But really, if I could choose any one of those, even more than the money, I died $108,000 in debt, even more than that, what I would want would be the scanning and copying machine. When I sold my library to Congress, I wrote out a very, very long catalog of the books, and then I made a handwritten copy of it. This took days. Imagine what I could do with your technologies.
Yeah. How many letters did you write in your lifetime?
I wrote 26,000 or so and received about half again that number, and I kept them all. But it was very complex because I would write a letter in draft, and then I would write a fair copy, and then I would make a copy of the fair copy so I could send one and keep the other. This is exceedingly tedious. I mean, I don't mean to call attention to myself, but I had better things to do than to copy out my correspondence. And now you just put your piece of paper down on some sort of glass, and by some miracle, you have as many copies as you want.
Thomas Jefferson was on with us this week. So congratulations to Pete. He remembered them all. And we'll make sure he gets a gift certificate from Lou Malnati's and also the American Weathermaker's Indoor Weather Keeper. It's a nice little gadget to keep you posted on the temperature and the weather, and American Weathermaker's sponsors that. You know, one time, John, Thomas Jefferson was on stage, and a child said, "President Jefferson, if you could have anything from our era to yours, what would it be?" That may be a different question than your birthday wish list.
Right.
And in that instance, he said, and it was just profound. He paused and he said, "Penicillin."
Wow.
He said, "Things that killed us, you pop a couple of pills and survive. Penicillin." Thomas Jefferson's going to be on stage with us again in August. We haven't set the venue yet, but keep listening to WGN. Follow me on Facebook, and I'm WGN King John, and you'll know when he's on stage. What are you doing today for Amy?
Well, today we have a fun show. We're talking about financial literacy. A shocking statistic, I think, and maybe has to do with more the sense of income inequality or whatever you have. Plenty of Americans under the poverty rate, but 57% of Americans have less than $1,000 in their savings account, which I don't know if that number shocks me or just is a state of how things are in terms of some people are just scrapping to get by paycheck to paycheck and can't get by. But we're going to hopefully offer some people some help if someone knows anyone, especially a group of individuals that are saving better are millennials, but they aren't investing at all. And that's a real missed opportunity. A lot of millennials stuffing the mattresses, money under the mattresses, keeping it as cash, which will cost them a lot in the long run, and maybe why they're doing that and how they actually compare to our greatest generation, which stuffed a lot of money under the mattress instead of investing it. And we're going to chat with two women who are organizing it's called the Vote, the 1920 Vote Your Money campaign, where they're trying to raise $1.9 million to invest in women-owned small businesses across the Midwest. We talked about income inequality with the pay gap day was earlier this week between men and women, and a lot of focus is on that. But only 3%, less than 3% of money that gets invested in companies in Chicago and the surrounding area goes towards women-owned businesses. So they're trying to get a leg up on that. And how women-owned businesses, it's not just for helping those individual women out, but how women who own businesses help the broader community. So it should be a fun discussion. We're in until one because no White Sox. So
John Hansen's in the studio in for Amy Guth, and he takes it away next on WGN.